So, welcome to our second lecture in Gloss Divino in Pittsburgh. Before we get into today's lecture, I wanted to address a question that came up last week about the Batyo textile factory. There was a question, if you recall back, there was a circular rotunda in the corner of the quad, and there was a question as to what function that was. Did a little research, was not able to determine that, but still digging. But what I did find is this this illustration here from, you can see from the factory, and the large, like, 4 or 5 story structure here is kind of prominent with some of the surrounding things around it. You can see the working floor here that we looked at, which is kind of really the key point of the design. But this being prominent, I'm assuming that this is probably the administration building or the management building with the working floor is kind of that, this space here that we saw last week, this being the prominent building. But this also, I found this also a postcard. And so this rotunda was in question was in this corner right here where these two elements came together, which is not shown in this. So I'm assuming that it was probably not original to the original design, something later. And actually the current building is no longer a textile factory. It's been renovated a few years back. And so it's got another use. So it's very possible the photograph that I pulled of the aerial was with the renovated portions. So, in 18, if you crawl back from last week's lecture, we were talking about Rafael Gloss Divino in Spain, back in Barcelona and Valencia. So in 1864, he married an orphan adopted by his uncle by the name of Pilar Exposito. And they had 3 sons within about 5 years, Joseph, Ramon, and Manuel. And then after about 2 years apart, due to infidelity on Mr. Gloss Divino's part, they had a 4th son, Rafael, Rafael III. And he was born in 1872. And so then, a little while later, when Gloss Divino was unfaithful again, he had a little bit of a habit of that, his wife and the 3 oldest sons left for Argentina. And that was in 1881. And so to avoid the social stigma of a failed marriage, Gloss Divino and his youngest son, Rafael III, departed for the United States. And actually they left kind of in haste. Even before, if you recall back, we ended the lecture last week on the theater that he designed, La Masa Theater. He left even before the theater was completed, so he never got to see it finished. He left for the United States. It's not entirely known why, but suspect because at the time the United States was thriving as far as industrious buildings were being built. It was a very strong economy. And so being an architect builder, he figured he could find work here. But in addition to that, if you recall back from last week, we talked about the Philadelphia Expedition, the centennial celebration in Philadelphia where he exhibited some of his work and it was well received. So he assumed that if he came to the United States, that he would probably get a similar reception. So he left, he brought, in addition to his son, he brought his housekeeper with him, as well as his housekeeper's 2 daughters. And they set sail for New York. Subsequently, once he got to the United States, he never returned back to Spain, which is an interesting note. So when he arrived here, he had about $40,000 in his pocket, which was a rather large sum at the time, at the back in the late 1800s. And so he also spoke no English, which, as you can imagine, made it a little bit more complicated to find work. But in addition to not speaking English, he also struggled with Americans' building practices that were different from the Europeans, and in particular Spain, where he came from. So there was a little bit of adjustment there. And in 1883, he took his $40,000 and he put it into an investment to develop a tenement, a housing tenement in New York City. And not only the design, but also the construction. He did all of himself. And we're seeing a section here of this tenement building. And you can see the Spanish vaults that he used for the floor system, as well as the roof system throughout the building. We also even see here, interestingly enough, a stair and the vaulting for the staircase, which we'll get into in 2 weeks, a little bit more detail on specifically how those stairs were achieved. But it employs the same thin structural clay tiles that's used in the vaulting. Unfortunately, when he ended up designing and building several of these buildings on a lot, but he did not understand or didn't think to secure the rights to the lot. And so, as a result, the landowner, the rightful landowner, ended up seizing the property, and so he lost the buildings as well as his investment, and so then he was penniless, and he returned to becoming just a draftsman, working for an office at $25 per week. In that same year, he also entered a competition, design competition, which he won for a German Jewish social club called Progress Club on East 59th Street. And then a year later, he also entered another competition, which he won for the design of a synagogue on Madison Avenue. Both of them were in a Spanish Moorish style architecture, which we're seeing here, the outside of this building. And interestingly enough, through those two competitions within the Jewish community, he made friendship with a real estate broker by the name of Bernard Levy, who ended up hiring him to design some row houses, which these photos are of, in a similar style to what he saw on the synagogue and the social club in these competitions. He liked what he saw when Guastavino proposed this. And so these row houses on the west side, he ended up building in 1885 and 1886. And you can see on the detail here, you can see the typical stepped brickwork that's very common in the Catalan region where he came from, as well as also the articulated pediments at the top of the building, creating this mass of weight that's kind of lifted up from the street level, as in addition to all just the articulation and ornamentation around the windows, the openings of.
Was that red brick originally? It looks painted.
It does look painted. I suspect it was probably originally just a natural brick, and it's probably been painted over time, would be my guess, but I don't know the for certain.
What did the back look like?
The back of the tenement?
Yeah.
I don't have photographs of that, so I can't speak to that, but the I suspect that it would be have a similar rendering. You can see back in here, it was pretty narrow because you can see the adjacent lot here of a building. So it was probably much like his tenements that he designed here that were kind of like row buildings.
So there would be an alley in the back?
Most likely, I would think so, yes. So in the 1880s, when Guastavino found himself arriving in the United States, there was very little tradition in construction for masonry construction. Much, you know, what he's bringing from the from Spain, what he's familiar with, this brick and stone construction. Here in the United States, most of the construction was with wood timbers, which were much cheaper and also significantly less permanent than the stone and masonry structures that you find throughout Europe. But this was a result of just the growth, the industrial growth that was happening at the time. The growth was so fast and so rapid. The timber frame was also much quicker to assemble and to erect. And so it had its advantages. But it also had its disadvantages, which we're seeing here. The Great Chicago Fire of 1871. So this had happened prior to him arriving here in the States. But it was pretty well known. Because it was so devastating, it wiped out 19,000 buildings through Chicago. And interestingly enough, the type of wood framing that was happening in that time period in Chicago is what's referred to as balloon framing. And that's where you have rather than the large heavy timbers that were traditionally put together centuries before, you know, in a mortise and tendon type connection, the timbers became smaller studs that we're familiar with today, 2x4s, 2x6s, that type of thing. Again, smaller in size, cheaper, lighter weight, all mostly for economy purposes, but these smaller studs was a new type of framing. You didn't have joints that were kind of joined together with wood pegs or bolts. They were put together with nails, what was referred to as a wire nail. And this wire nail was a new innovation that had just come along in this time period. Machines that could turn out these wire nails, basically nails made out of cut wire, which we know today as a 16 penny nail. Or 12 penny nail. And so these wire nails, because the wood was smaller, lighter weight, it could be held together with these smaller wired nails as opposed to larger bolts that might be needed for much heavier timbers. But as you can imagine, the smaller frame wood also probably caught fire much easier, burned much quicker. And in particular, this type of framing, balloon framing, is where the length of the wall studs run two stories. And so they're not joined or broken at each level. And so as they rise two stories, there's a cavity space that's created at the floor level where it spans across a story. And that cavity space allows flames and fire heat to pass up through from one floor to the next. And so if you had a fire start out on one floor, it could very quickly spread to the next. And that's basically what happened in Chicago, because a large part of the construction at the time was in this balloon framing style construction. Subsequently, as a result of that framing change, introduced what's referred to as a platform frame, where the studs don't span from floor to floor. So at least at each floor it's cut off. It's a little bit harder for the flame to spread. Slows it down from going from floor to floor. And then also additionally building codes came online as a result of that, just to make the structures safer. A year later, after the Chicago fire, Boston experienced a fire as well. This one was not as extensive. It only wiped out 700 buildings. But as a result, much like in Chicago, there was a desire to seek out buildings that were resistant to flame, resistant to burning. And so there was a demand for the, with the builders, the architects, the developers, to create fireproof buildings. And this is where Raphael arriving to the States a few years after these fires, where these fires were kind of in the minds of these builders and architects, arrived perfect timing with his masonry tile construction that was much more resistant to fires than the wood. So, in addition to this, the developers could also rationalize spending more money. Where before economy was driving most of the decisions for the wood frame, now the loss of life, or in probably more importantly to them, loss of property, was significant to where spending a little bit more money on the front end made some sense if your property, if your building is going to survive potential fire from your neighbor. And so in 1885, when he made friendship with this this real estate developer, Bernard Levy, he encouraged him to patent his vault, his tile vault system that he was using in this these buildings that he was creating for him, which Raphael did. It was, he received his first patent for a what was referred to as a fireproof construction system. It was the first of about 24 patents that he would receive over the life his lifetime. He was, as we're going to see in the coming weeks, Raphael was quite innovative, as well as his son. And the two of them were continuously innovating new ways of not only using their bricks, but also new ways to market their bricks. In particular, in this case, marketing as a fire-protecting material. And so we're going to look at coming weeks, we're going to look at kind of some of those innovations that they developed and they patented to help sell their wares. He also, around this time, because of this system, was an answer to these fires. He anticipated quite a lot of interest from the architects, the developers that would want this type of system. He also attracted investors. He was able to go from being penniless to having about $230,000 worth of investment into his company, which he then changed from the Guastavino company to the Fireproof Building Company, which he established in 1888 in New York City. So in 1885, he had entered two more additional design competitions. He did not win either one of these. However, in both cases, the winner of both these designs ended up retaining him for his fireproofing system for the floors of the buildings that they were to build. And one of these buildings that was in this competition was for the Boston Public Library that he entered. And this was, the competition was ultimately won by an architectural firm by the name of McKim, Mead, and White. And they were building, in Boston, this competition for a public library was basically in competition or rivaling the library that was built in the public library that was built in New York City a few years prior, as well as to that extent the Carnegie Library system that we're familiar with here in Pittsburgh. And so Boston wanted to create one of these great public spaces in the same way. Interestingly enough, The lead design architect of the firm McKim, Weed and White, Charles McKim, was a protege of Henry Richardson, that some of you might be familiar with, that designed the Allegheny Courthouse here in Pittsburgh. We're going to actually be looking at that building in a couple weeks at this vaulting that's in that building. Guastavino was involved with. So the trustees that were putting on this competition for the Boston Public Library, one of the requirements for the design of the library was that it was fireproof. And so these architects, McKim and White, were seeking out methods and ways to develop and build this new library in a fireproof manner. And so Guastavino, knowing this, set up a demonstration where he built, we're seeing a kind of illustration here, built one of his vaults, test vaults, to demonstrate his system to these architects that had won the competition in an attempt to try to win over the construction of their floors and roof systems. And these test vaults that he built, he ended up loading up, putting sandbags on top in excess of 100,000 pounds, which is the equivalent of about 8 elephants. And then once he loaded it up, he set fire underneath the vault and set it on fire for a period of time, multiple hours, and then put the fire out and took measurements to see how much the vault might have shifted or how much it might have sagged as a result of being exposed to the heat. And then once he took measurements, he set it on fire again and did this multiple times. And through this, he was able to demonstrate that not only did the vault not collapse and not fail under heat with the weight, but it also moved very, very, very little fractions. And so this impressed the architects and developers at the time to the point where they ended up retaining him for the floors and ceilings in the library. In fact, I'll read here a portion from a letter from the job superintendent where he met with Guastavino that came out to the job site that was trying to win him over. This job superintendent ended up sending a letter to McKim, the lead architect, and he said, "Mr. Guastavino thinks it is a great pity that the whole ground floor could not have been put in by his system, with no beams whatsoever, only a few girders. He says if we would give him all the iron beams for the ground floor that are already on site, he would sell the iron and would build the whole ground floor for nothing. We are quite favorably impressed with Guastavino's system and have quite a bit of it drawn in our sections. It will be decided at once that we are going to use it." So here we find him going out to the job site and seeing these steel girders that are going to be used to hold up the floors. And that's just to hold the floors up. That doesn't include the flooring that's coming in. And Guastavino's convincing him that just for the cost of the beams alone, he could build the entire floor system. And so in addition to that, a floor system that is fireproof. This obviously swayed them and convinced them. And not only this, but Guastavino was able to mobilize, once he was swayed this job superintendent, mobilize his workforce within a couple days. And so from June 15th to July 1st, just a matter of 2 weeks, his company installed 5,000 square feet of vaulting for the Boston Public Library, which is roughly about 400 square feet per day. And he was so confident with his abilities that he, even in his contract, he wrote in that he could guarantee to supply 4,000 square feet per week if needed. Here we're seeing an example of some of this loading where they would load up weights onto a vault. You can see down here below the very thin couple layers here of the vault curvature here that's has some stone placed on it as well as weights to demonstrate its strength. Here you can see it's noted here 112,000 pounds. And then this was what they would then place a burner underneath and set it on fire for testing to demonstrate its strength. And then we can also see here, so once he started the construction, this is some of the lower vaults of the ground floor, and you can see the beams here that are spanning around that the vaults will tie into, and you can see the layers of the brick here, five layers thick of the thin tiles that are laid in to create these arches that would then follow through from the arches. The brick would be laid in for the vaulting. We can actually, in this photograph, you see Rafael Guastavino himself standing atop one of the arches to demonstrate the strength. You can see here as the vault then is filled in between the arches. Here's one arch, here's another arch, and so they're working the vault together from the two ends to meet. You see over on the side here, completed vault. And so again, this is just a technique where you can also see the layers that are three layers here thick for the vault, and you can see that they're stepped back, so that way each brick as it lays in could finger in and have that stepping to be able to extend them out without the centering or the formwork to hold it in place.
Where did he get his labor force?
That's a good question. So generally on a job, depending on the size of the job, the Boston Public Library was a pretty good sized project. So as you can imagine, it would have a larger labor force when he's trying to build, at this pace. You can see here in this photograph, just a couple masons here that are laying tiles, one, two, and three here. It appears as if each one has a vault. So I suspect they probably laid, I'm not too sure how many of these vaults they could lay in a day, each one of these, the technique is to lay kind of the first layer with this quick setting plaster of Paris as a set. And then once that sets up, the subsequent layers would come on top with a much stronger Portland cement, which would take much longer to set in. But nevertheless, each one of these would lay in pretty quickly, which was part of the attractiveness of this system. As you can see here just in this photograph, we've got six vaults, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And you can see at least four masons here working on these four. So I would suspect that like a typical construction size would be maybe a dozen or two for a large project of masons. Where they would come from, a lot of times there was cases where there's some advertisements, and we'll see some of these as we go forward, that he'd be putting out advertisements for skilled masonry masons. And part of the problem would be that he'd bring them in and he would train them how to build in this system because they hadn't been familiar with this. And then once they learn the technique, they become potential competitors at this point, going out and trying to win jobs over. And so this was a large part of why he was so adamant about patenting all these developments, to prevent these people that he has to teach in order to be able to handle a large size project.
Where did all the tiles come from? Who's manufacturing?
So in the beginning, he was buying the tiles from manufacturers that were making these tiles. He would specify the type of tile, this thin tile, which was not common again in the States. But he would specify that and they would make it to specification. We're going to see in subsequent lectures where once he kind of gets into business and his business grows, he realizes that he can control the product and the quality of the tile much better and do custom tiles that we're going to see by making his own tiles, which is what he ends up doing is creating a plant to make his own. Great question. One other thing I'll point out here, I missed. You can see this wood formwork right here. Two of them together to create the profile for the arch. And you can see this guy is laying in some wood straps that he's nailing to these two profiles just to create a surface that they can lay that initial first course of brick across. And it's not so much that this is necessary to do this because they could lay these bricks up from the end and work their way, you know, to the center from the two sides and can bring them together. That can be done without this kind of support. But what the support does is it enables them to use this profile in all these arches. So that way all the arches are precisely exactly the same. So they all line up. Whereas if you were to lay them up without the arch, you have variation that's going to occur. And so you're not going to get that precision. But then once this goes into place, then the vault would finger in between these arches. And they would just continue that same profile as they fill that in with the vault.
So it's basically a template?
Exactly. That's right.
Is anybody doing this today?
Not too many. Most of the work that's happening today is usually restoration on older structures, not so much new structures going up. With this type of technique. Then we can see here from the underside of the vault, interestingly enough, to take note that the bricks are laid out in a grid pattern, squares, as opposed to the herringbone type profile that or pattern that we're going to see coming up in subsequent lectures. But this initial early vaults that he's doing here when he first arrived to the States was a very simple grid pattern where the bricks are just laid side by side. Here we can see some of this finished detail inside the library. And you can also see here where the bricks are this herringbone pattern, which is a lot more decorative visually, which is precisely the point. At this point when McKim came around and saw this, in the lower vaults, and he realized how beautifully this looked as a surface. Just visually, having the detail and the variation in the tile, he realized the potential. And so between the two of them, they decided to leave the tile exposed as a finished material, rather than what they originally planned, which was to plaster it. And possibly once it's plastered, then to put some ornamentation in the plaster itself or painted decor. So this unfinished surface was, again, another innovation, because if you recall back from last week, back in Spain, they never left the tiles exposed. It was a structural material. It wasn't a finished material. And so as you can tell with this photograph, it's quite dramatic visually. Just the variations you get in the tiles, adding some modeling to it, dimension.
Well, one of the ceilings you showed first did have something painted on it, back a ways.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, exactly. So this is another part of the library. So the library, each room is kind of handled differently, and we'll see that coming up here shortly. This is actually in one of the entryways where you're exactly right. There was some ornamentation that was plastered and painted.
There's the arch that you can tell between the pillars, and then there's another arch that comes up higher.
Right.
Is that a different different?
Well, you have an intersection here of this larger arch that's going over the entire entryway, mm-hmm. And then as you pass through this wall, it's divided up into multiple smaller arches that create passageways through this wall.
But that one that has
the higher arch, is that just decorative, or is that a different plane than the...
It's not structural.
This right here, or are you talking about this?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the extension of the shaping from this arch that comes out. As this arch transitions into this arch, you get this...
It changes angle a little bit.
Exactly, the plane, the surface of it changes, and so that's being kind of accentuated here with the ornamentation and the outline that's put in.
It looked like that, but I wasn't sure. I love to have a...
Yes, no, it's quite breathtaking. So precisely to this point, once McKim realized the potential for using this brick as a finished material, Guastavino immediately started showing him drawings of different patterns that he could lay this brick in. And so you can see the typical herringbone pattern that we get that he's most known for. But this variety of tile work was then proposed, and then from room to room, basically the library became a place for him kind of to show off all of his wares, his potential of what can be done. Here we can see broken up into coffers that each one, the brickwork becomes even that much more ornamental. All of this, like the various patterns, would range. He would charge a different price depending on the complexity of the design, but back in the 1800s, it ranged from 26 to 34 cents per square foot.
Yeah, but people make $75 a month, too.
Also interesting enough is that at this time, McKim was trusting Guastavino with his judgment as far as the aesthetic, the design. He would kind of give him some freedom to propose these design patterns and as well as carry them out. So he was getting a little bit of freedom from the architect that traditionally would have the entire design completely drawn out, and they would just be a matter of the builder building exactly what's drawn. He's getting a little bit of latitude from McKim, recognizing that this guy is more than just a mason. He also has some sensibility for design from his past. We can see here a couple drawings that Guastavino put together, proposals for the vaults. So here he's proposing not only the design structurally, but also the tile work from a pattern. Similar thing here to the lower arcades. Again, he would produce these drawings to provide to the architect to show them what his plans were for how he was going to structurally support these, as well as the design of them. So, following the Boston Library and this relationship between McKim and Guastavino, McKim would recommended to his fellow colleagues, architects, that they use this system. And he received a letter at one point from an architect asking him his opinion of the Guastavino system, and he responded back that he should come out to Boston and visit the new library to inspect the system himself firsthand. And he added that I would not hesitate to place my entire confidence in the Guastavino system. And so here we see much the same way this letter that we saw last week from the king that was sending his masons up to Valencia to kind of learn of this new system back in the 1300s. Here we have a similar kind of recommendation by McKim talking to his colleagues about, again, coming out firsthand and seeing this stuff in person so that way you can see how it's actually built, how it's constructed, and see the end result of how this thing appears. And that this is the way that design innovation kind of spreads is through this kind of word of mouth and also through this firsthand experience. And this is what we're going to see, how Guastavino went from New York City to Boston with the Boston Library, and then subsequently out across the United States to where he ended up by the end of his career and his son's career. They built over 1,000 structures across the United States, as far as out west as California. And so in the 1890s, early 1890s, he had, by this point he had established, in addition to his Boston office for the library and his New York office that he started initially, he also established an office in Minneapolis, Chicago, and in Providence by the early 1890s. So at this point, I'm going to take just a brief 5-minute break. If you have any questions, I'm sure happy to answer. But it's about 4:02 right now, so we'll pick back up here at 4:07, 4:08.
Donated the land. I'm originally from Boston.
Okay.
So I know this library. It's in Copley Square you're talking about.
Right, right, right.
So I don't remember who donated the land. And so before he lost the lot, a building,
right,
because somebody else owned the property.
Right.
So how did he make sure that this wouldn't happen again?
Put your mic on.
Oh, thank you. So he, the land for the library was, there was a group of industrialists in Boston that put up the money, and I suspect that the land was probably owned by one of those to develop this building for the public. And I don't know the actual particulars on who those people were, but you know, in a similar way to here in Pittsburgh with Carnegie, with his libraries, you know, he would take his land and kind of build a building that he would retain as the building as well, but it would become a public building that eventually would then get turned over to the municipalities and control, that type of thing.
And the other question I have is, when he built the tenements in New York, was that before fire escapes were required?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So that was that's the kind of thing was coming online with the building codes to try to make these structures much safer. Fire escapes, even just openings, like before that, like tenements were notorious for having internal rooms with no exterior windows or anything like that. And so even just creating rooms where you're going to have people, you know, sleeping necessitated that you had to be on an exterior wall that had a window, so that way at least you could have a way to get out or get fresh air in as well.
And also wooden stairways, because the tenements in Boston had wooden stairways.
Right, right, exactly. Huh. Yeah, so I mean, it's all those things prior to the fires obviously were not in place, but all those things were coming online as a result of the fires. These new codes, the fire code in New York City, for example, was the first building code that came about as a direct result of the fires. And then just over time, those building codes continued to expand and develop further and further to encompass more safety measures.
Okay, thank you. Same question just asked, but what materials were used to support the upper floors? Was it more like brick columns that supported the second floor, like right here? If this was the second floor of the building.
Yeah, so like, so this is his vaulting here,
mm-hmm.
And then they would build up on top of this vaulting. Usually this would be the same type bricks. They would just be kind of laid up, and then they would come across here with a brick type structure here as well. So this would all be his kind of like his thin tile bricks.
So if it was a 5-story building, they would just keep going up with tile the whole way?
That's right. In fact, like his early tenement, you can see here, you know, like multiple floors, and each one has got this vault you know, which is the ceiling for the for this room, as well as the floor for the room above. And so that would just stack up and.
But these would all, this would all be.
These, so then these vaults would come down and be supported at this point, and these walls would also be masonry just to carry that weight.
Okay.
So the essentially the entire structure would be this this masonry system.
No steel.
Right.
Is that synagogue still in existence in New York?
I believe it is. Yeah, it's on Madison Avenue. Yeah.
Any idea where?
I've got, I think I have the address here. Let's see.
I might go look at it this weekend.
Oh, yeah? You're going to be in New York?
Yeah.
Nice. I don't have the address.
What's it called?
I don't have that with me either.
I can just look up synagogue on Madison.
If you send me an email, I can send you the address because I've got it back at home.
That's cool.
I can give you the address and the name of it.
So there are still buildings in New York that he did?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In existence.
Yeah, no, there's quite a few.
Wow.
Yep.
Cool.
You'll get a list of them in the second half of the lecture here today.
Okay. I know there's a lot in Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah.
I saw the list.
Right.
Chatham's swimming pool, which is now the boardroom.
Right.
The ceiling.
Right. Yeah, we'll be looking at that one next week.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yep.
I just took a detailed look at Baker Hall.
Okay.
Went by the library and went all the way up the staircase to the top. I'd never been up there before.
Yeah, phenomenal. Yeah.
So my question was, arches push laterally.
Right.
So here they're pushing against one another, but how does the termination in the outside wall resist that lateral force? There's no steel band like that circular structure.
That's right.
And there's no flying buttress.
That's right.
So
you can see like the exterior walls are a little bit wider. There's a little bit more weight and material there. Compared to like the interior, even this interior one here.
Yeah, but those don't need it because the two arches push against one another.
That's right.
But where they terminate, that's.
That's
the
right.
Issue.
Yeah. So these, it's primarily just the mass and the weight. Just by fattening these up, you have a little bit more weight and mass on there. And that mass is going to resist it. But you're precisely right that even with the weight or these larger walls, necessarily is not always enough to kind of resist that lateral thrust. And that, you know, which we're going to see here going forward, was something that Guastavino just kind of learned by intuitively, by trial and error, you know, knowing, you know, that you need a little bit more here. And like you said, they eventually put steel, iron bands inside to cover for that. And we're going to see some of that going forward as well. But that's also where, right around this time when like these structural engineers are also becoming a profession, they would try to put numbers to this mathematically and figure out how much is that thrust and that's pushing, and to figure out what you need to resist that.
Trial and error presumes failure. You learn through failure.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, much like his demonstration with the fire and loading the bolts up and putting the fire under it, if it survives, it's very impressive, you know, because you can say all the numbers you want about how much heat and how much load, but if the thing's still standing, it's
when you're building a big structure like that,
it just increases.
You've never done it
exactly
before.
Right, and so what you'll find in these larger structures from that time period is the width of the wall here is significantly narrow, and it tapers, and it gets, as it comes down, there's, like you said, there's more load being applied, which translates to more thrust, so you just need that much more to kind of resist. Yeah. At same note, as you can imagine, like this wall here is, you know, 4 or 5 stories tall. You have the entire weight of this wall that's like on this point. So, you know, the thrust that's coming here or here, you know, there's more resistance here than there is up here that only has this much weight. And, you know, the French with the Gothic, you know, the buttresses that we're familiar with, the flying buttresses and that type of thing, a lot of those buttresses were just, you know, they were these tall, narrow things that just kind of were up in the air, and it was just a matter of just trying to load up as much weight, and then it just kept growing taller and taller until they had enough weight on it that it resisted this push.
Yeah,
cool. Yeah, great questions.
So after he, after Guastavino won the bids for constructing the vaults at the Boston Library, in 1889, May of 1889, he was invited to give a lecture entitled The Theory and History of Cohesive Construction, as it is applied to the timbrel vault. This was this term timbrel vault was a term that Guastavino came up with, and it was a way of trying to define this vaulting system that he had. And this lecture was delivered to the Society of Arts at MIT, just down the street from the library. And so in this lecture, he built a, for the lecture, he built a sample vault to show them the technique of how this is done. But in addition to building this vault and demonstrating, he also delivered a speech, which then subsequently was published a few years later. So it's available to read. But I'll read you a little sample here, a passage where he said, "Up to the years of 1866 to 1868, and just for reference, if you recall back last week when we were talking about his education, he enrolled in the Master of Works program in 1875. And so this time period he's referencing is about a decade prior. But he said, the professors of the Academy of Barcelona, which is this program that he enrolled, one of the most illustrious of Europe, and a city where tiles are more in use than in the rest of the world. These professors did not commence to pay any attention to this style. And when at last they did, it was only to comment incidentally on its resistance and its possible utility. But they did not make any study of it. Notwithstanding the fact that they were constantly walking over the floors constructed with this system, so small was its significance to them as a science. On the other hand, this want of attention is explained by the lack of cements proper for such kind of construction. The want of a proper cement of an invariable brand on which to base the calculations was one of the main obstacles which involved the Catalan and Venetian architects." And so here in this passage, he's describing the fact that these schools that he went to study, these professors were spending most of their time talking about construction methods that were occurring elsewhere, like the Romans, the French, the Gothics, these methods with stone in most cases, they spent very little time talking about this tile technique that the Spaniards were Venetians were using, despite the fact that, as he's saying, the buildings that they're actually teaching in are built this way. So it's right here. And I think that's also part of it, is that it was so known by all of them. They were so aware of it. A lot of them probably spent quite a bit of time actually building these things for as an apprentice or on their own houses. It was something that really didn't need to be taught necessarily, because they all understood it intuitively. But at the same time, they didn't hold it kind of in high regard. They didn't see it as a serious form of architecture or construction, much the same way they held the French and the Italians up in regard. And I think part of this also is, if you recall back from last week when we talked about the kind of origins of this method, came out of Valencia in the 1300s as a result of an economy where they were trying to substitute a cheaper material for the stone that traditionally would be used for these vaults. And so this economy concept is still carrying through here into the 1800s, 500 years later, where it's viewed as a cheaper way to build, or something that is chosen for other reasons than aesthetics. And so this is something that clearly with this passage, Guastavino's taken exception to. He's trying to, here in the States, as he's building these structures and he's exposing these bricks that we're seeing in these vaults, he's trying to raise it up to become more than just a structural system that is being used for economy of scales and it becoming a, in his mind, a legitimate form of architecture from an aesthetic perspective. And so we also see here this kind of division between these trades of these masters of works, which is the training that Guastavino had, where he's building from experience, building from kind of like the know-how that he's developed as not only in his training in school, but also when he gets out and he's working out in the field, as compared to these this new line of architects that are referred to almost as paper architects because they design on paper. They don't design out in the field by building. And these paper architects were primarily coming out of Paris at the time, the École des Beaux-Arts, which was a tradition that had gone back a number of years, but in the late 1800s became very popular, and it became the preeminent school for educating architects within Europe and by extension the rest of the world. And so there's this division and fracturing that's starting to happen as a result of this rise of these paper architects, and which is the way that McKim is, for example, with the Boston Library, is delivering his designs from to Guastavino on paper. It's a drawing. McKim himself, I believe, was a student of the École des Beaux-Arts, studying in Paris, but. Guastavino is here as a master of work, where he is. He also draws his drawings in order to communicate with the architects, but he also demonstrates physically in the actual material. Is his more intuitive and kind of his preferred way to communicate. And so he continues on in this lecture at one point, commenting to this point of this empirical method of building, a way of building, where he says, in counseling the architecture students in attendance of this lecture, he said, let them go out to nature instead of to the crude engineering and the conflicting ideas of various ages. And so he's feeling like, you know, going out into the natural world where you're dealing with the natural elements, you're dealing with gravity that's putting weight on these buildings, as opposed to looking at the ancients, like the French and the Italians, the Greeks, that was being taught or was being modeled after by the architects of his time. We also here's a photograph of this is the Boston Public Library. And this was an accident that happened during the construction. You can see down here in the lower part of the photograph, you can see one of his arches that continues across here, and then the vaults that are coming off of that arch. This was from a stone that weighed 2 tons up that was being erected up higher up in the library that fell. And as it fell, it came down on top of the vaulting floor system here of Guastavino's below, came crashing through, broke it apart. But what impressed the builders, the architects, the developers of the time when this occurred, not only did it make, you know, great news splash because it's like, you know, this thing came crashing down, but they were impressed the fact that the arch that you see here, the vaults, all stayed intact. As this the stone came through and made this opening, this didn't continue then to crumble and fall apart around it. It stayed intact. And this spoke to just the inherent strength of this system. You can even see here like the layers of the vault exposed where it broke through
And also, incidentally, too, you can see this is the upper floor here, and you can see the infill of material that kind of fills that void. Once they would build these vaults, and they would lay in almost their scraps from the job site. It was a place where they could kind of deposit the waste, fill up this void before the floor structure would then come on top of that.
Did that infill add any strength or any purpose, or just fill the void?
It would just primarily to fill the void was the case.
It did, actually, so one of the techniques that he also developed, Gaudi used it frequently as well, was they would take bottles and they would throw those in there. I think sometimes it was just empty bottles from the end of the workday, you know, just to kind of throw it in the place where they would, you know, throw their garbage. But the bottles would then, as the other stuff would fill in, the cement and that type of thing, it would create a pocket or a void. And it was a scenario where by creating this pocket, it made that infill a little bit lighter because it's not filled with all the weight. And so then it would make the structure have less of it, this inherent weight to it by creating these pockets. So that was a technique that over time developed as well. We can see here, again, this vaulting system. This is the lower level of this cathedral in New York here that we're going to take a look at. But in particular, this last photograph that we saw of the floor that stayed intact, a large portion of why this was integral was this use of Portland cement. This new type of cement that was coming out of London was superior to the cement that was more lime-based that was used traditionally. Because it was coming out of London to the States, it was imported. It was much greater expense than the cement that was made locally. But it was far superior in strength. And this was demonstrated by his structures that stood up and withstood this type of damage. And so this is something that kind of grew his reputation as building these structures that were much stronger by his use of this imported cement, Portland cement. In fact, continuing with this lecture that he gave in MIT, there's a quote here I'll read. He said that in some cases, the risk and danger caused by the irregularity of the materials were so plain that the workmen were afraid, compelling me to remain in the works to inspire confidence and success. And so here again, it's like we have in the United States, we have this very industrious economy where things are growing, expanding quite rapidly. We have materials that are just being produced to kind of fill this demand and need for this quick construction. As a result of these fires, a lot of these structures are becoming masonry, whereas prior, you know, the builders are familiar with this wood timber type construction. So with this new craze for fireproof masonry, you have all these various manufacturers that are coming online creating cements and bricks and mortars and all these types of materials that are needed. And so with each one of these, there's no standardization, there's no kind of oversight or some type of bar that they have to meet. And so this is where it becomes just kind of the expertise of the builder in the selection of what he's using. And in Guastavino's case, he's spending the extra money to bring this Portland cement in from London that he knows is a much superior quality cement. But in particular, using some of the local bred cements that are coming from the various factories, you don't know how they're going to actually perform, how they're going to hold up, even one batch to the next. To the point where, as some of these are failing or not working out well, the actual workmen are losing confidence in the materials. And so you see, you know, here him speaking to the fact that not only is this a problem he has to resolve, but it also speaks to the fact that Guastavino spent most of his time out on the job site right along with the workers, not only to kind of inspire this confidence he talks about, but also just to kind of oversee the quality of the work and kind of teach them by example.
Question, I'm guessing that the structure underneath it, the wood, goes away.
That's right. Yes, this is a temporary structure here. Again, much like we saw in the earlier photograph where there was a template that was used to create the profile, because this is a much larger span, the template is a little bit more robust, but essentially this is acting as a template to create this curvature for the arch, to support it. And then once the arch is created, then they span the vaults between them, and then this goes away once that's complete. So this again, goes back to this this idea of this master of works. This is really what Guastavino, of all of his talents, this was the talent that was really key, was his intuitive ability on site to understand what was needed, how to kind of demonstrate and build, because he could step in and he could do better than what the actual workers were doing at the time. And so it was a matter of kind of lead by example. And so he continues in this lecture, he says, nothing was done about investigating these structures to which I have referred, and no coefficients were derived. This only can be obtained when we can depend upon materials and mathematical regularity and with powerful apparatus for determining their reliability. In countries like this, where we can find more than 20 guaranteed brands of quick-setting Portland cement of different degrees, in a country where the clay can be used for those constructions with advantage and regularity of manufacture, and finally, in a country where we have powerful apparatus, coefficients can be obtained as we have been doing so for the last 5 years. And so he's speaking to the fact that as this kind of production is happening, over the last 5 years or so, he's starting to notice that there's enough kind of momentum of this construction that's happening to where manufacturers are getting better at making their wares, seeing where the inferior product fails and how to improve them. And they're starting to develop standards and starting to develop kind of measures to where primarily just for economics of competition, that you want your cement to be better than your competitor's cement, but developing this kind of bar to be able to, as he says, to create coefficients where you can start to kind of analyze and you can calculate how these perform from a physics perspective. And so he says, from these special advantages, it seems, these works have culminated in the United States with specimens that have no rivals in any part of the world for lightness and resistance. And so he's speaking to the fact that he believes that the work that's going up here in this time period, the 1880s, 1890s in the United States, is superior to any of the work that he's familiar with around the world. And so we jump forward here a little bit. In 1909, which is coincidentally about a year after Rafael Guastavino passed away, he dies in 1908, early 1908. About a year after that, his son, who has been kind of working along his side as an apprentice, kind of learning from his father, his son never goes to any formal education like Senior did back in Barcelona, but he's learning from probably the best teacher out there. And so his son at this point has taken over the company, leading the business for a number of years, about a decade. Senior kind of started tailing off in the late 1890s, which we're going to see in a couple weeks, a little bit more of that. But Here in 1909, Raphael Jr. Is supervising the firm's largest dome at this time, with a diameter of 132 feet, which is New York's Cathedral of St. John the Divine, we're seeing here. This dome, which we see here at the top of the picture, this is over the main portion of the church. This is what Raphael Jr. Was commissioned to create. This 132 feet is the diameter from this point to this point. They would assemble this at a pace of 18 inches per day. So they started at the perimeter and worked their way in and up. And so they would basically lay about 18 inches worth of the dome each day. And so the following day, they would lay another 18 inches. And when they lay that 18 inches, they'd be standing atop the 18 inches they laid the previous day. And so they kind of worked their way up.
No wood frame under that.
This is with no scaffolding, no wood frame, no supporting beams, no buttressing. All of this was new to New York City. They weren't familiar with this type of construction where you had no scaffolding. Even these earlier pictures we just looked at where they had the formwork for the arches, this was done with nothing at all. He devised this system here. You can see this cabling system where they tied a cable off down at the center of the dome on the floor. Here's a figure for scale to give you a sense of how tall this was. This cable went up to this point, was tied off, embraced at the base of the dome, and then they would from this point that's fixed, they would pull a line that would be the radius, and so then they could use that line as they work their way up. You can see here as they're working away. This is a photograph when they're about halfway up the dome and still needs to be filled in, but as they're working here, they pull the line to this point and they would use that to create their profile to maintain the symmetry and the precision of the shape. And so again, as the dome is laying up, the circle's getting smaller, the bricks are fitting in, they work up. You can even see here that 18 inch increment from as it's being laid up, and all of this is done without any type of support below it, scaffolding. As you can imagine, if you were to have to support this, you would have to infill all of this with this kind of scaffolding that you're seeing on the outside here that's supporting stone. And the weight of the stone that has to fill in and be supported as you work your way up, this is not the case with the brick. So in the time that he was laying this up in 1909, the New York Herald newspaper ran a headline that said, "Disaster defied on the Cathedral Dome. Young architect upsets all theories of engineers and erects vast structure." And so this was almost kind of perceived by the public as well as the professional trades as almost defying logic, defying possibility, because it's something they had not seen before, how something could be built with no support below it.
How were the workers accessing that, you know, to actually lay the brick, and how were they storing their materials? If they're not doing it from the inside, are they on the outside?
They're on the outside, and they would have to kind of work their way up, and so just getting material to the top was a feat in and of itself. But that, exactly, that precisely. They would be up on top, working their way up as they come up and continue. Another point here is, you notice too with the profile, you have the scale and the size and the proportion of the structure and how razor thin this dome is on top. It's spanning 132 feet, and at the center point here, it's only 4.5 inches thick. So I mean, it's roughly about that thick at the top. And this is structurally supporting weight, the weather, snow, all these elements that are placed upon it. This was At the time, it was put up as a temporary structure, if you can imagine. They had built this church to this height, this opening. They really didn't have any kind of understanding of how they were going to enclose it. They had an idea of they would, much the same way the church was built with stone around it. They figured that they would cover this over in stone, but that would take great expense, all the scaffolding, the stone material, the weight of it. And so the church at the time was tight on budget. And so when this Guastavino came along that they recognized could do this for a fraction of the cost, a lot less material weight, all of these economies, they took them up on it. But it was considered just a temporary enclosure. At some point in the future, they would probably take it down and replace it with a roof that's more fitting of this structure. But like most things, temporary, it ends up becoming permanent and never was replaced.
So they're building up from the bottom, and they put a row of bricks, and they put another row of bricks, 18 inches worth of bricks. Do they don't stand on that to do the next layer. They'll put like four layers before they go stand on it, right?
That's right, yeah. So, but the first layer is this plaster of Paris that sets up in about 10 to 15 minutes to where the brick is secure and it holds in place. They can then come on top of that with the next layer with the Portland cement and laminate that on, and then a third layer on top of that. All of those, that Portland cement is going to take at least a day to set up to where it becomes firm. It's not completely cured towards 100% strength, but it's strong enough after a day to where you could walk on it. And so that first layer with the plaster of Paris that sets up within about 15 minutes, that gives it enough strength to support the weight of the bricks and the cement. But it wouldn't hold any more weight than that. If you stepped on it with additional weight, it would collapse. But all they need is that first layer to support the weight of the bricks for the first day. Because then by then, the plaster, Portland cement would set up, have the strength. The following day they come back, it now can support the weight of a person, support the weight of him carrying a load of bricks. And so they would kind of figure the way up in about 18-inch increments each day. Here we can see these arches that are in the four corners of this this dome, supported with these large stone columns at the four corners. Each one has a stone arch between it. These arches would, as you can imagine, would have to have all kinds of formwork to support them until we get the keystone in place, because all of this weight is pushing together at this point. But once these arches are in place, and this is the point where Raphael comes in his commission, and he's starting down here. In fact, you can see a little arch here that he's putting between this stone arch and this stone arch. He's spanning between them, and he's starting to build up from here in the corners here, working his way up to this point. And at this point is where the dome is going to start from the arches up. And so he has this infill that he has to fill in between to get to the point to create this ring that he's going to set the dome on top of. This infill between it, let's see here. Between these arches, he lays this up in about a time of about 5 weeks. Once he gets up to the top where the dome starts, he lays the entire dome up in about 10 weeks. So in the process of about 15 weeks, he has the entire thing complete. Here we can see a shot from the underside. Also, again, significant is if you look closely, you can see the individual tiles. You can also see they're kind of laid in rings, bands, as they're going around. A very simple way to lay these, and also, this is that first course that's on the underside. That's the plaster of Paris, that's being set up. And so each of these rings, as you can imagine, as he's laying these in, creating another band as they go up, that then becomes laminated with the subsequent layers on top. Here's again a section through it, a little bit closer. You can see
how it tapers off. Down here at the bottom, you can see the thickness in multiple layers. It gets up to a point where it gets a little thinner, a little thinner. And then at this point at the top, it's just about 4.5 inches, roughly about 3 or 4 layers of brick at the very top. But as he works his way down here, he might have a dozen or so layers. And so it increases in size. And that's strictly because of the load path, that the weight that's on this is all being transferred this way. And so you need to thicken it up to carry additional weight as you work your way down to this point here at the bottom of the dome. So I wanted to end today's lecture on a little story here. Recently, 1961, which was just for reference, it's about 2 decades after the last Guastavino vault was constructed here in Pittsburgh, which we're going to see in about 3 weeks. The last vault that was built was at the East Liberty Presbyterian Church, and that was in 1942. So about 2 decades later, a gentleman by the name of George Collins, who was a professor of history of art and architecture at Columbia University up in New York, was sitting inside of St. Paul's Chapel, which was a structure that was built in 1907, we're seeing here. And as you can see, the dome on this structure, on the inner side, you can see the stereotypical herringbone pattern that we're familiar with Guastavino's work, even in the pendentive portions here outside of the dome, filling in between the arches. This herringbone pattern continues. But he's sitting here at this chapel during a memorial service for a colleague. And as you frequently do sometimes when you're sitting around, you look around and you look up, and he notices this pattern on the ceiling. And he this ornate herringbone pattern of tiles with all the curves and the colors reminded him of the work of Antonio Gaudí in Barcelona. And which he had just recently completed a book writing about Gaudí's work. And so it was front of mind for him. And so as he studied the ceiling, he realized that this ceiling that he was sitting under used the same type of vaulting technology or technique that Gaudí was using over in Barcelona. And so this kind of discovery, which he had not made notice of prior, caused him to take a little bit more careful look at the architecture that was around him, which is interesting in and of itself, the fact that a professor of history of art and architecture is not that astutely looking at his environment says something. But nevertheless, in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, to his surprise, he found this style of vaulting, this Spanish style vaulting, in buildings all around him, from the Riverside Church that was built in 1930, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine we were just looking at, 1909, and several other buildings that were on Columbia University's campus. So then, now he was really intrigued. So everywhere he went in New York, he looked around. He found out that Grand Central Station in 1913 had the same type vaulting. Carnegie Hall in 1891. Ellis Island in 1917. The Queensboro Bridge was built with the same type vaulting in 1909. Pennsylvania Station, which is one of the buildings no longer standing, 1910. It seemed like that every block in New York City had at least one of these vaults, as an example. And so then, a year later, in 1962, he's traveling to Pittsburgh to give a lecture. And while he's in town, he looks around at the buildings in Pittsburgh, and he counts over 30 buildings in Pittsburgh that have the same type vaulting.
which is precisely where this course is going next week and the subsequent weeks. We're going to look at these 30-plus structures. And that this is when he realizes that that these vaults were not built solely for the aesthetics. This was not just a decor or a finish that was applied to this vault for decoration, but it was actually more than just that. It was an entire structural system that was inherent within it. And of these interlocking tiles that we're familiar with in this Spanish technique. And so, as a result, he wanted to find out, where did these all come from? Who was doing this? And so, you know, being a history professor of architecture, he looked into all of these buildings he was taking note of. He looked at the architects, the builders, the developers, who was behind all these things. And they were varied architects. And then, but he found that one of the common things was that all of these vaults were being built by a single family, a single man, the Guastavino Company. And then as he dug a little deeper into this Guastavino Company that he didn't know of prior, he found out that, ironically enough, here in 1962, it had just closed its doors in July of 1962, was the last month in operation. And so he reached out to one of the surviving heirs of Raphael. Raphael Jr. at this point was no longer alive. He passed away in 1950. He reached out to one of his heirs, inquired about this, and found out that they had kept documentation of all of their buildings that they had built across the country. All of the drawings that they had prepared, they were meticulous at keeping these documents. And so he worked with the family, this company that was now closing their doors and liquidating, and he arranged to have all these documents be brought to the Avery Library at Columbia University, where they're housed. And so this preservation. Yeah, question.
You are on point. I heard an interesting twist to that particular situation. That is, when he called, they had just thrown all those documents into a dumpster.
That is correct. That's right. So the timing was pretty significant, because he arrived in Pittsburgh in May of 62. And this is when he found out that these vaults were outside of New York City, because that was prior to that. He was only looking around in New York. And then when he realized that, wow, these vaults are beyond New York, because I found some in Pittsburgh when he was in town to Pittsburgh in May, that's when he realized that it's more extensive than just someone that was doing this in New York City. And that's when he started to dig, look into the history of these buildings. And then, like you said, the company closed down in July, and they had just thrown away these things. He was able to, as figuratively, kind of dumpster dive and pull these things out of the trash, and ended up securing them. And so I mentioned this story. One, it's a fascinating story as far as how we come to know of his work today, because as a result, now there's not only is the documents there, but the students are studying the work because of the documents, and they're learning of it. But for me, what's interesting is the fact that just in a period of two decades, that despite the fact of this career that we're looking at in this course of Guastavino and his son, that built over 1,000 structures across the country, most of these structures, the most significant buildings in these cities across the country, because they were so massive in their scope, they were by necessity some of the most significant structures in social structures, religious structures, civic structures. But nevertheless, we have some of the most significant buildings across the United States, and within a period of a decade or two, how they're built, who built them, has been forgotten, to the point where even in the trade, a professor of the history of architecture doesn't even know two decades later where these came from without a little bit of digging. And so it's fascinating to me how quickly and how easily things are forgotten in just kind of society, for one, But also, too, the importance of preservation to be able to kind of retain that information, that knowledge. Because as we see with Guastavino, we saw last week, he's using a technique that goes back to the 1300s. And at the time he was learning, it was over 500 years old, this technique. And the only way that that technique was remembered was being passed along from generation to generation, father to son, typically, out in the field. And also passed along through actually building with that technique. And so it continues to where that technique is learned and remembered all the way through. And then now here at Guastavino, we see with this course is bringing that technique to the United States. And so now it's thriving across the United States in the late 1800s, early 1900s, creating these buildings, but then almost evaporates. And we'll get into the evaporation in subsequent lectures, why that happens. But I just wanted to point it out here today with an interesting tidbit of how we came to learn of Guastavino's work.
What was the name of the professor again?
George Collins. Yeah.
Can I take a picture of that before you get
there? Sure. So with that, we'll see all of you next week. And we'll be, next week we'll dive into some of these works here around in Pittsburgh that relate to, we have over the next 4 weeks, each week is kind of divided up into a theme. So next week's theme is what was referred to kind of as building science within the trade and the building science behind the materials. And so we'll see examples of that in the Pittsburgh buildings.
Do you have any idea how many of these you built, the company built over time, and how far throughout the United States?
Yeah, so it was across the entire United States. They went as far as California, as far south as, I believe, in Florida, and well over 1,000 structures.
Did they use this in any of Robert Comey's buildings?
I don't know that for certain.
Mostly churches and things.
Right, yeah, a large majority of these were churches, as we'll see next week. As far as his specific work, I don't know for certain, but I would not be surprised if they were.
I know the guy who's doing a history of him, and I actually live in Comey's house.
Oh, yeah?
So maybe I'll reach out to the guy who's doing the history of Comey's work and see if he knows.
Yeah, no, they should know for certain, I would think. Thank you.
So it looks